This is Hamilton Wendy interviewing the very famous Simon Sebag Montefiore, all the way from London, here in Johannesburg. Simon, you've written a tremendous number of books. Tell us a bit about what it's like to be Simon Sebag Montefiore.
That's a very hard question to answer, especially for me. But actually, it's, you know, for a writer, I think everyone knows, and anyone who writes, you write too. Everyone knows that, you know, if anyone reads your books, it's a bit like being an actor, being a writer. You know, if you're in work and people are buying stuff, you're pretty grateful that you can keep working. So I'm just delighted that people read my books around the world, and it's really fun coming to see it in a new country. I have a sort of saying that every time it's in a new market, you know, a new country or a new language or something, the book has a new life, and that's a nice feeling, which I like a lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, you're quite famous. People know about you. I mean, you had a lot of almost, I think, sold out at Franschhoek and here in Johannesburg. Your launches have been very successful. Tell us a little bit about your career and how you got to this point.
I was at a boarding school, and funny enough, after my boarding school, I wanted to experience South Africa. So I got a chance to work in the gold mines of President Steyn gold mines in Welkom as a sort of teenager, as a sort of holiday job.
Yeah.
But it was quite an strange experience because I was there for about 3 months on my own, and I didn't really know anybody. I didn't really know anybody in Welkom, obviously. And I was going down into the stopes of this incredibly deep mine. We would go down in the cages at 4 a.m. in the morning. So South Africa was an interesting experience, and it was the time, it was still the height of apartheid. Now, now we know that apartheid was already doomed. But I already wanted to go to trouble spots. I wanted to write about troubled countries. I wanted to understand apartheid. So that's really why I made that decision as a schoolboy to go and do that weird thing. And it was an adventure to be a gold miner for a while. And then I went to Cambridge, and then I became a banker, believe it or not. And that wasn't a great success, as you can imagine, since I'm really...
Well, there's a bit of a family history of being bankers.
Yes, I mean, the Montefiores were bankers, and the Sebags were also bankers, and they were partners with the Rothschilds in the 19th century. And they were very interesting. They were an interesting family. I say they because I sort of... It's many generations later now. But it was a fascinating time, because, you know, the Montefiores were from Italy and Spain. The Sebags were from Morocco. So... We were Sephardic Jewish,
okay.
Jewish financiers in a very exciting time when it was, and they became British, and it was a time when to be a British banker, a powerful British banker, was to be incredibly powerful. So that was interesting. And we were a Jewish family, and we still are a Jewish family. And of course, we also had special links with Palestine that became Israel. And that in some ways led to some of my writing. But after Cambridge, after this banking interlude was kind of hilarious in a kind of comic way. And then the Soviet Union started to break up. So I just started to go to all the wars there. I mean, as soon as the Soviet Union started to sort of shake and the war came down.
So this was in the early 1990s?
This was in like 1990. I sort of decided I could no longer be an investment banker. And I just went. I actually went to the sort of Soviet Union, which was in its last months, and I went to Moscow and Leningrad, of course. But I also, the most exciting thing is I really went to all these places like Tbilisi and Yerevan and Baku, and everywhere I went, kind of war broke out or a coup broke out almost instantly. And having spent all my life as a sort of, you know, at a sort of posh English boarding school and then Cambridge. And with only one interlude of adventure in Welkom, the tragedy of those wars was kind of for me a kind of blessing, because, and also as a writer, you know, the grit of war is something that you've got to see, really, you know, if you can. And so I started to write there, and I wrote for big newspapers, The Times.
I was going to ask you, did you have some sort of journalism background before you became a historical writer?
Well, not really. I mean, as a teenager, I'd done one thing which was rather amazing, which was I wrote to 10 Downing Street, and I said, can I come and interview you? And for some reason, Mrs. Thatcher said, come and interview me.
Wow.
So I went when I was, I think this was like earlier in the year before I went to Welkom, and I went to Downing Street and I interviewed Mrs. Thatcher. And afterwards, there were some notes on her papers were issued quite recently when some, you know, when her papers were being opened after 30 years or whatever. And one of them was, one of them said that this boy was Simon Sebag Montefiore. This boy was one of the most impertinent schoolboys she'd ever met. And then she said, like, there will be no more interviews with schoolboys in Turn Downing Street ever again. And there weren't until she left.
And you only discovered that recently.
That was discovered quite recently, in the last 5 years, I think. I remember I saw it and I was kind of laughing. So then I was, it was, you know, I was in all these fascinating places, and I got to know the president, the warlords, the head of the opposition, you know, the local writers, and you know, I saw terrible things, I saw fascinating things. I really was going back and forth between. I lived in New York then because I'd left over from when I was a banker, so I was travelling back and forth, and it really was a sort of it was 5 years of great adventure.
But did you spoke Russian by then, am I correct?
No, and I didn't speak a word of Russian, and that got me into terrible trouble because, for example, in Chechnya, you know, I hadn't got an interpreter. When I was flying down to Chechnya, which was about to be invaded by the Russians, I met a guy on the plane, and he said to me, like, he was actually a murder detective, and he said in Chechnya his department had never found a single murderer because they're all blood feuds. Anyway, he said, I've got an interpreter, I'll send him to you. And then, so the next morning I opened my hotel door and there was this little boy there of 7. It was his son. So I took him to interview the president and everything. And of course, they were all very, they thought it was very odd.
Yeah, sure.
I had to sort of assure them that it wasn't like that. He really was my interpreter.
Yeah.
So, and when he was interpreting for me, he almost got me killed because he said there was a moment when half the government was blown up in Grozny by the Russians, obviously. And afterwards, I said to the vice president, I think, you know, I'm so grateful that Your Excellency, that you've survived and when all the others have died. And of course, he translated it the wrong way around, which almost had fatal. So then I decided I was going to not be write a war correspondent anymore, and I started to write Catherine the Great and Potemkin, and that's how I started to write my book.
Well, I'm glad we've got to that point, because one of the things that I think you talked about, I was at your launch the other night as well, is you're a historian and you're a writer, and you were saying at your launch that being an historian today particularly is, and I'm quoting you here, you said it's a kind of sacred profession. Tell me a little bit about what it's like to be a historian, why it's important, and what it's like to be a writer.
Well, I think to be a historian is a sacred trust at the moment, especially. There are times when historians are barely needed, actually. And I think, you know, this is one of those times in history when civil society is under attack everywhere, when the idea of truth is under attack, and when democracies are really struggling to maintain democratic normalities. And I'm thinking of Britain, I'm thinking of America, thinking of South Africa, you know, with state capture. Mm. And, you know, so easily in South African history, you know, several times in this country could have veered off into really basic sort of corrupt dictatorship. And, you know, it's an amazing, South African history is an amazing thing. Mm. It's an exception to so many expectations. But that's another subject. But so this is a time when, you know, history is really important. And then as a writer, you know, this is a time when words are really important, and the power of words and the responsibility of words. And again, that all comes back to sort of in democracy to the way politicians behave. And, you know, again, it matters very much in South Africa, but in England and America at the moment, there's this kind of complete collapse of discourse. And everyone's just kind of raging at each other, using words like traitor all the time, completely wrongly. The very words racism or anti-Semitism or all these words have lost their meaning. Mm. So, you know, it all goes back. I mean, in my teens, my favorite writer was George Orwell. But, of course, he kind of understood all this, well, long before everybody else did. So to be a historian is an important thing. To be a writer is an important thing. And I'm a historian and also a novelist, but for me, the writing is as important, and that's unusual for a historian. For me, I'm quite a literary historian, and I spend as long on my books, you know, rewriting them and writing them and trying to get the language, the sentences beautiful as I do as I do researching them and thinking about the history, to be honest.
And as you said the other night as well, you want them to be entertaining.
Yes. I mean, history should be entertaining. And of course, there's no point in giving people lessons from any angle, whether from the past or the present. It's no good being a teacher if no one's interested and you're boring people. So entertainment is not something to apologize for in this area. I mean, you need to get ordinary readers to read this stuff, not just specialists. And that's the big challenge, of course. And I sweat blood just trying to rewrite these things so that they are readable by people who don't necessarily
know.
Well,
if I can interject, I think you do it very well.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
You were talking earlier about how you are Jewish heritage and also British heritage. And I know in your book, Jerusalem, there's quite an emphasis on a tolerant Jerusalem rather than a Jerusalem divided by extremes. And I mean, as you pointed out, in the United States and Britain, the extremes are beginning to attack the very fabric of democracy. Strange enough, I don't want to talk too much about South Africa, but I think our recent election showed that actually the center is holding quite strongly here. The extremes did take a little bit. But I'm thinking Nicholas Taleb, his book,
yes,
you know, Skin in the Game.
Yeah, yeah.
One of his chapters, it says, "The most intolerant wins." What does that say about our era at the moment?
The most intolerant winners.
Wins. So in other words, the most intolerant faction is the one that tends to win.
Yes. I mean, that's very true. And his books are good, aren't they? I mean, yes. I mean, I think it's a sort of, I just think factions, extreme factions, are shown in histories. If you look at the great revolutions, the French, the Chinese, the Russian, the English Revolution in the 17th century, you know, it's the extremes are always better organized. They have better belief. They have total conviction. They have better belief, and more intense belief. And revolutions have a way of kind of driving themselves towards the extremes. So I think that's another way of approaching what he said.
Do you think that's happening now in the world around us?
Yeah, I do. I mean, if you look at the sort of, if you look at, you know, Brexit is what's happening this month.
And is
everyone
it
in England.
Happen, yeah.
Well, I don't even know what's going to happen. But, you know, obviously being English, it's great to be in South Africa, by the way. I mean, I don't want to be in England at all.
Tell us a little bit about that. Why is it great to be in South Africa?
Well, because, you know, in all my talks, I've kind of joked that it's just great to be in a kind of functioning democracy after leaving a kind of, you know, failed state beset with corruption and chaos and fury. And so it is actually quite nice to be out of England for 10 days, as I am now. It's really good to be here. But yes, I mean, it is, you know, there's a drive towards extremes that and every extreme has its counterpoint, which grows up. So any veer to any direction, any extreme creates a natural consequence, a counterpoint. And you see that all the time in all these countries of the world. And that's a terrifying thing. Mm. You know, in Britain, we've got the far right, a sort of section of the far right and the Conservative Party that is now obsessed with Brexit above all else, above national welfare, really. And at the same time, you've got the Labour Party's fallen into the hands of an ultra-Leninist, Stalinist faction that really doesn't have the same values as mainstream society in Britain, tolerant values. I mean, it's like beset with kind of vicious anti-Semitism. And, you know, it's got a leadership who amazingly think that, you know, Venezuela is a model for how to run a country, and they really, they've said that many times. And who disbelieve any democratic or Western account of anything, and much prefer to believe, you know, the Russians, for example, or the Iranians, or to befriend Hamas and Hezbollah on top of, you know, a democracy. So we've got a very, very strange English politics is now suddenly unrecognizable.
I think that kind of sums up the way I'm seeing it from a distance. But history plays a role in that position where we, as the world really, I mean, I have to say I do think South Africa is a bit of an exception. I think we've really shown that some over 80-odd% of people voted for a centrist party. But taking it back to the kind of broader world view, history is often, it never stays the same. It's always reinterpreted. I mean, yes, you were praised for your quote-unquote revisionist history of Catherine the Great and Potemkin.
Yeah.
But how do you sort of keep, when you were in Russia and Georgia and places like that in the 1990s, you were doing the old cliche of seeing the first draft of history as a sort of proto-journalist.
Yes.
How do you keep the present-day politicians honest with your writing of history?
I mean, history, I mean, you know, as we all know, Marx's famous quote that it happens, you know, first as tragedy and then as farce. But you know, it doesn't repeat itself. That's the simplest thing. If it did, it would be a lot easier. There are various, the trouble with kind of political knowledge of history is that there are various moments like 1940 with Churchill that every political leader knows about. So George W. Bush, for example, he didn't know any history. He just knew that. So, you know, everything was, you know, Saddam Hussein had to be Hitler. And, you know, and that was all he knew in history.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he wasn't Hitler at all. And so that was sort of sometimes, you know, too little knowledge and too concentrated knowledge is actually a bad thing. And that's, I mean, one of the things I'm doing now is, this isn't quite answering your question, but I'm now writing a world history.
Oh, wow.
And actually, just of the whole world from the beginning to the to now. And I'm not quite sure how I'm going to do it, but the point of it is...
Is H.G. Wells on your...
H.G. Wells is one of the... H.G. Wells has done one. Yeah. Sir Walter Raleigh did one.
Okay.
Andrew Marr's done one recently. And, of course, there are lots of textbooks, sort of penguin histories of the world that sort of have everything. But the point about doing world history is you do at least... What I've found very comforting and interesting now is that, you know, you really do have perspective looking at it from that distance. Well, you know, when you're writing, when you're inside the sort of Romanov court or inside Stalin's court, or, you know, you're basically just obsessed with that period, and you're in a frenzy. And you see this with lots of writers. They're always in a kind of frenzy about their subject, as if it's the only thing that matters in the whole world ever. So, but with Catherine the Great and Potemkin, you know, I, of course I'm aware of historiography, but I don't think my readers are very interested in the historiography.
Tell me, what do you mean by historiography?
You know, I don't think they're very interested in, you know, the complex debates among academics of the meaning of history, the meaning and analysis of states, and how, you know, whether it was an economic fashions and so on. I think that they
want the story.
They want the story, and they want you to. But they, I think, they want you to have made a decision. So what I do is I read all the historiography, or I read all the academic stuff, and then I decide. Well, I mean, a lot of it is nonsensical. You know, a lot of it is a fashion. That's what I was trying to say earlier, which is like a lot of it is just a fashion, and a lot of history is a fashion.
And it doesn't get through, I'm guessing, to the ordinary person. I was amused by one of your the quotes I read about. In when I was doing the research, and you were doing a book launch on your Stalin book, and apparently over the loudspeaker system it said Joseph Stalin is signing his books in the lobby or something.
Yeah, and you realise that you need to teach people the history and entertain them, and it's a very difficult combination because you want my books. I try and get my books to be sound academically, and often with new research if I can find some. And then I try and write them for people who don't really read history, and it has worked. I mean, they're read widely, you know, surprisingly widely, considering that. I mean, Stalin, the Court of the Red Tsar, for example. I mean, that's Stalin in power. That's a very, very abstruse, complex, weird subject. You know, the Communist Party under Stalin, and of course, you know, I had to make a lot of decisions. I simplified things, and I didn't write the same book that I would have written if I'd been an academic writing a definitive book of Stalin. I would have, for a start, I would have written 3,000 pages, and I wrote 700 pages. So,
which is hard to know what to leave out.
Yes, and it's still sort of that. And people often say to me, "God, that's a very long book." And I was like, you know, really, actually, it's pretty short. It's really quite short. And Jerusalem is really short compared to what it is.
Well, famously, I think everyone thinks it's Winston Churchill, but I think it was Pascal who said. The French writer, the intellectual. I'm terribly sorry that I wrote such a long letter because I didn't have time to write a short one. Tell us a little bit about how you craft that narrative.
There used to be a rule where it had to be sort of 500 pages was the rule, but now it's actually gone up to 1,000 pages. People buy longer books now, but you know the crafting of it is I do the research first, then I just think very hard about a way of doing it. You know, a voice, and that's. I quite often have an initial kind of prologue, key scene that sums up all the sort of themes of the book and is also exciting enough to hook somebody who again might not be the person who would read these sort of history books normally, and then I just write it as I feel, and I write in a frenzy all the way through to the end of the book without any.
I believe that's quite a frenzy. Your wife's had to go through some sleepless nights while you've been writing all night. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh well, I play loud music. I've been limited to using earphones now, but my poor wife has a lot to put up with. But there again, she's also writing her books.
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, Santa Montefiore is quite well known as a writer. I mean, my wife said to me, you know, she immediately, when I said I'm interviewing you, she said, well, ask him about Santa, which I'm doing now.
Yes.
Tell us, you've written books together, you've had a wonderful relationship. Tell us a little bit about that sharing.
It's a great thing. It's a great, because when I met her, she always wanted to write novels. And she'd written some that weren't right, and then I said to her, like, well, actually, she said, what name should I write under? And I said, well, this, you know, if you're going to be a romantic female novelist, Santa Montefiore is the perfect name. And so we decided that would be her name. And actually, a lot of people think it must be a made up name, because it sounds so kind of exotic and slightly florid, but actually. And then she writes a book every year. She's really hardworking. She's very talented. And her books are sold all over the world now. Some countries, she sometimes has, like in Holland and Belgium, she often has three books in the bestseller list at the same time. So she puts us all to shame, basically. Yeah. And she's got that very conscientious, industrious nature. So she gets all her things. I have many days when I'm completely failing to do anything and just... phoning people, talking to people on the phone for hours on end.
Or that's a dangerous thing for
daydreaming, you know, daydreaming or going else. Or, you know, sometimes I never even get dressed.
How are you with Facebook?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've wasted a lot of time in my time. I've wasted so much time on Facebook, on Twitter and everything. But once I start work, I go to the 4 o'clock rule, which is no social media until after four.
Okay. That's a good rule, I think.
Yeah.
But tell us, there's something similar about Santa's books, which I haven't read, but I've read about them. And for example, your book about the Romanovs, which is, you say in the prologue, the political is always personal.
Mm.
The power is always personal.
Yeah, power is always personal. Especially in what you might call immature or, you know, coarsened systems, you know, where power becomes, I mean... as you had here under the Zuma presidency, you know, when you've got somebody who really is just suddenly disregarding the actual government and is actually running the country through their own personal entourage. And that happens in all democracies. I mean, even in healthy democracies, it happens. I mean,
well, it's happening with Donald Trump, I think.
Well, totally with Donald Trump. But, you know, even Thatcher or Tony Blair... in our country, they ran their governments. Really, they had contempt for the actual ministers who were kind of, you know, Labour or Conservative apparatchiks. But they ran it through a very talented group of people that they trusted in Downing Street. And I think it's always been so. And obviously, if you're writing about autocracies, it's even more intensely so. I mean, you know, Emperor Paul I, you know, promoted his slave barber to be a count and one of the richest.
He was a Russian emperor, and he was
the one who was murdered in 1801. When they killed him, they stomped on his head. It's pretty brutal assassination. And it was after him in 1801, because he was assassinated before 1801. Everyone wanted to be Tsar. It was a great job to have. And after 1801, they kind of worked out that, you know, actually, you were quite often assassinated. And so every time one of the Romanovs became heir, they burst into tears out of sheer fear. Yeah.
Well, that's great, because one of the things that's fantastic about your books is the color and light and energy that you bring to the narrative. They're not just a kind of dry relation of events. So in nonfiction, you have a kind of duty of care to the reader, an implicit understanding that you will be accurate and you will tell them things that really happened. But in fiction, you need to, and you've written very powerful fiction, you need, I think, to make people believe.
Yeah.
How do you kind of transition from one to the other?
I should first say that, you know, like people often say to me, and in South Africa, people have said to me, like, by the way, how much do you make up in the history
books? In your history book.
Yeah, they say, how much do you make up? Because they read like a novel, you know, it's, you've got all this stuff. Mm. And actually, I don't make up anything. I'm really careful about it. I just use material that probably an academic wouldn't use. I use a lot of memoirs. But I never sort of say, if it says in one of my books, you know, his heart was beating, you know, I will never have just made that up, as some historians do. I will never do that. That will be because he said to somebody, my heart was beating then afterwards, and they recorded it in their memoir in a letter somewhere. And that's the way I work. But fiction's really different, and I love writing fiction. And actually, I mean, the Moscow trilogies, I'm very proud of the Moscow trilogy.
Sashenko, yeah?
Sashenko, One Night in Winter, and Red Sky at Noon.
Okay.
And they're now making, they're actually making films or dramas of all the books. Now, everything I've written, really, is now being done, which is really exciting.
Yeah, that's great.
None of them have been made yet, but a lot of them are on the verge of being greenlit or not greenlit. And that's the problem. Because even though there's huge demand for all these TV dramas like Game of Thrones type of things, what you don't realize is that, you know, making a program of 10 parts is a colossal sign-off of budget. And it can be like more than 50 million quid. So people don't do it in a sort of hurry.
Absolutely. Well, let's just, one thing I haven't asked you about, you've also written children's books along with your wife, Santa.
As you have.
Yes, I have, and I'm working on the third one of the trilogy at the moment. I need to get back to it this afternoon.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about that writing of children's books. There's a lovely kind of humor that you have. I haven't read them, but I've read some excerpts where you talk about how the royal rabbits of London are always under threat at Buckingham Palace from the pack of snarling corgis.
Yes.
Which I think in some ways is given to the parents to have a little giggle while they're reading to their children. So.
Well, I mean, I think these books, the art of these books, you probably agree, is you know, it's got to be for children. The children have got to love it, first of all. But it's also the people reading it, have, you know, reading it to them often are the parents. And so my books, the Royal Rabbits of London, which is now, which will be four of them.
Okay.
And that'll be the end of it. But that they have lots of jokes in that grown-ups will get. And which will hopefully will laugh about, which the children won't notice and won't care about. But we've really loved writing them together. The Royal Rabbits of London is going to be a movie from 20th Century Fox. It's going to be a hybrid animated movie like Paddington was.
Okay.
And so the script is just at its second pass now, and it's pretty good. So we're very excited about it. Anyway, we wrote that together, and it's just actually rather lovely doing something with your wife.
You don't fight over it.
We haven't fought over it. We've actually got on very well, and we've worked out a way of doing it. And we've had crises over the storyline, as you do. It's easy once you've created the world, but you've got to create the world with its rules.
Absolutely, and that's so important.
Yeah, and that those rules have to have an integrity within the story. So we've had big sort of discussions, but actually, it's been really fun, and we've loved doing it. On the other hand, we've done four, so that's enough now.
Yeah, sort of, you know, what message do you have for South Africans with your extraordinary grasp of history and of world events?
I think South Africans should be very proud of what they've achieved, what you've all achieved here. I mean, I think living here as you do with all these corruption scandals, I think people don't realize what an achievement modern South Africa is. And in my letters book, you know, written in history, you know, there's a Mandela.
This is
letter.
Your latest book.
My latest book is called Written in History: Letters That Changed the World. And there's another sort of companion volume coming out in September, Voices of History: Speeches That Changed the World. And so and they're good for presents, and they're books of stuff that people know, but they should know. But it's also an entertainment. They're meant to be a sort of treasure chest.
They're wonderful. I've been dipping in and out of them. I mean, we haven't got a lot of time left, but I would strongly recommend to the readers, there's a lovely letter by Nelson Mandela to Winnie Mandela, an extraordinary letter from Donald Trump to Kim Jong-un. So they're not only from Pliny and other people in the past.
There's Michelangelo, there's Leonard Cohen, there's Mozart, there's Stalin, there's Hitler, there's everybody. So these are letters of just like love, sex, death, humor, horror, and war and peace. And I just hope everyone enjoys it. And there are real lessons in that book for all of us about words and the responsibility of words.
Well, I just want to finish off on a final note. I was at your launch and you read from a letter, that a woman who died in the Holocaust, but somehow the letter survived by being given to her husband. That actually brought a lump to my throat.
Yes.
And at the same time, there were also some very amusing letters as well. So I would just say to the readers out there that it's a wonderful book. And go out and get it. And thank you very much for being with us.
Lovely to be with you. Thanks a lot. This has been fun.
You've been listening to Final Take, a multimedia live production from the Tissot Blackstock Group, publishers of the Sunday Times, Business Day, and Financial Mail.